Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. LeBron James and the Miami Heat are struggling in the postseason, even as the high schooler many think will be the next LeBron makes his way toward the pros. Ahead on Only a Game, meet Jabari Parker. Also, Manchester City posts a win for the ages, tempers and bumpers flare at Darlington Raceway, and a scrum featuring rugby and literature. Also ahead, golfer Ken Green goes forward on the links after a series of tragedies, including a highway accident that destroyed his right leg.
I would have had no chance at all to play any professional golf. So my feeling was, okay, we'll cut it off. I'll put the dopey prosthetic on and I'll play it.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Miami Heat find themselves down 2-1 to the Indiana Pacers in their NBA Eastern Conference semifinal series. Adding to the discomfort this week were injuries and internal discord. As Phil Latzman reports from WLRN in Miami, players and fans have begun to wonder what it will take to bring the lustrous Larry O'Brien Trophy to South Beach.
After a 5-game ousting of the injury-plagued New York Knicks in round one and the early elimination of the Chicago Bulls, a repeat cruise to the finals seemed likely for the team and the player the rest of the NBA loves to hate. But standing in the way of LeBron James and the Miami Heat were the Indiana Pacers and an unexpected injury to one of their own. Chris Bosh managed to complete the three-point play, but the third and most maligned member of the Big Three, sometimes referred to as the Big 2.5, crumpled in pain and left moments later with an abdominal strain that will keep him out indefinitely. Miami managed to hang on for a Game 1 win, but the loss of Bosh showed in a home loss Tuesday in which they scored just 75 points, and then again in dramatic fashion in the Pacers' blowout win on Thursday night in Indianapolis. A weary-looking and possibly injured Dwayne Wade had one of the worst games of his career, failing to score a point in the first half and finishing just 2-for-13 with 5 points. The usually composed Wade was even seen shouting at his head coach Eric Spoelstra on the sidelines during Miami's second-half misery.
We're not going to win a ball game, with Chris Bosh out and me scoring 5 points, obviously. So I take a lot of onus on that. So it's frustration in that. You want to do well. You want to give yourself a chance to win.
All of this puts more pressure on the very broad shoulders of LeBron James, who won his third Most Valuable Player award last week but is still seeking that elusive first NBA title. He says he's not worried about his pal, D. Wade.
It was one of those games where he couldn't make a shot, he couldn't get into a rhythm. And as a team, we just tried to pick it up. And we couldn't do that tonight. He's a bit better player. Like I say, he's one of the best in this world. So we're not too much worried about it.
Heat fans have watched in horror as the last two games unfolded. Jonathan Stubbs was among the patrons at a South Florida sports bar. He wants LeBron to live up to his prediction he gave when he came to Miami nearly 2 years ago.
He promised us not one, not two, but several championships. And right now we're still waiting on one.
But Stubbs says he doesn't know if it will be Miami's year anyway.
The way the season's been going, I don't see him winning a championship this year because I think OKC's going to take it all the way. I do think that we need to change. We need to get rid of one of the big three.
And this mother and daughter, Lynn and Jenna Jocelyn, have differing expectations.
I think they made it pretty far anyway, so they did good, regardless of the outcome.
Not far enough, I say, because last year they almost made it one game away. So this year, no, it has to be the whole way.
For Only a Game, I'm Phil Latzman in Miami.
How good a basketball player is Jabari Parker? Good enough so that as a 17-year-old high school senior, he's drawn comparisons to LeBron James at the same age. Good enough so that when Parker's father, a former NBA player, called Kentucky coach John Calipari with congratulations on winning the NCAA championship, the coach said, "I want to coach Jabari." Jeff Benedict's story about Jabari Parker is in the current issue of Sports Illustrated, and the author joins me now. Jeff, welcome back to Only a Game.
It's great to be back, Bill.
You have spent time with Jabari Parker, and you've seen him play. Convince me that these comparisons with LeBron James are warranted.
Well, on the basketball court, I think they are. The kid's 6'9". He can dribble tremendously well with both hands. He passes with both hands. He even shoots with both hands. He can knock it down from behind the arc with ease, and he's got a first step that's been compared to Oscar Robertson. But when he goes inside, I mean, he is a thunderous force under the basket.
The school for which Jabari Parker has been playing is Simeon Career Academy, which always seems to have a nationally prominent boys basketball team. How does that happen?
Well, part of that happens because a few years back, the head coach, Robert Smith, went there, and one of his first teams, he had Derrick Rose. And Derrick Rose won two championships his junior and senior year. They won the state title in Illinois. And so a couple years later, when Jabari had to pick a school, he wanted to go to the same school Derrick Rose went to. In he comes, and now for the last 3 years, they've won the state title. And if they do it next year, he'll win it four times.
All right. Now, you've mentioned how well Jabari Parker plays, but how is he handling the sort of national publicity that his performance and his team's performance have been generating?
He handles it remarkably well because he just ignores it. He's sort of disinterested in it, to be quite honest. He really is a humble kid. He's grounded. When I went to Simeon the first time, I met the janitor within 5 minutes of stepping inside the school, and the janitor didn't want to talk to me about Jabari's basketball skills. He wanted to talk to me about how humble he is. And I probably heard that from no less than 25 strangers that I interviewed in Chicago while working on the story. And the first word out of everybody's mouth is, he's the most humble kid you'll ever meet.
The first page of your SI article includes two photographs, a small one of Jabari in uniform and a large one of him with an open Bible. Jabari Parker is a Mormon, which meant that when he turned 16 on a basketball trip, he had to return home early to become a priest. How did his teammates relate to that?
Well, in a lot of ways, they can't relate to it. First of all, you know, there are very few Mormons in Chicago to begin with, and even fewer African-American ones. But his teammates really love this kid, and they respect him, and they know he's religious. They know he's a Mormon. They know he doesn't smoke. He doesn't drink. He doesn't use four-letter words. There's a lot of things he doesn't do. And then there's things he does that no one else does. Like, he gets up every day at 5 o'clock to go to a Bible study class 3 mornings a week. He spends a good part of his day on Sundays in church and doing public service. And becoming a priest is normal in the Mormon church for 16-year-old boys, and I think his teammates have just gotten used to the fact that Jabari does some things that are differently, but they respect it.
You mentioned that Jabari doesn't use four-letter words, but I understand that his coach uses them liberally. How does Jabari handle that?
He laughs at it. You know, kind of the same way I do, Bill, to be honest. I sat on their bench. Robert Smith's a great guy, and his mouth is a little salty sometimes, especially when the game gets heated. But, you know, when I asked Jabari about it, because it stood out to me, you know, the first time I noticed it, I thought, wow, that's kind of a shocking thing there. And so I asked Jabari after, I said, what about the F word? And he's got this great, huge smile, and he just kind of broke out in laughter and said, you know, I love Coach Smith. And it's one of those things where I think Jabari is very comfortable in the world that he's in, which is the tough, aggressive, in-your-face basketball climate of inner-city Chicago. And he is at the top of that world, and yet, in many ways, he's not in that world.
In 2 years, Jabari will have a significant decision to make. Mormons customarily go on a mission when they're 19. What's he going to do?
You know, he hasn't decided yet. And the truth of it is, a lot of kids in the Mormon church don't make that final decision until they get closer to 19. Jabari just barely turned 17. He's a junior in high school. He's got a couple more years to think about it, and I don't think he's made up his mind yet. If you read quotes from people, and there are plenty of things on the internet right now where everybody thinks they know where he's going to go, I don't profess to know where he's going to go, and I've spent a lot of time with him. I know he's interested in winning a national championship. It's hard to find someone who's more competitive on the court than him. He wants to win. My guess would be he'd play a year because he could go to the NBA right away if you didn't have the new requirement requiring him to sit out a year.
He isn't the first athlete faced with the choice of going pro or going on a Mormon mission or staying in college, you know, all of those alternatives. Danny Ainge, late a player with the Toronto Blue Jays and the Celtics, now the Celtics GM, and quarterback Steve Young did not interrupt their athletic careers. Did Mormons criticize their decisions?
Well, you know, I think both of them have taken some criticism for not going. I interviewed both Steve and Danny for this story. In fact, we have a really interesting sidebar story in the magazine about those two guys and some other Mormon athletes who've had to face this difficult decision. And I think the beauty of it is that they're not compelled to go. Some go and some don't. And I think for Steve Young and Danny Ainge, they made the decision that was right for them. Steve Young still plans to go serve a mission for the Mormon Church as with his wife at some point. There are a lot of retired couples that do that, and I think so there are options available to these guys.
You're a Mormon yourself. Did that influence your approach to this story or the work you did on it?
No question. I'm the only Mormon writer who does stories for Sports Illustrated, and I was very much drawn to this story, not just because he's a great basketball player. Naturally, if he wasn't, we wouldn't do this story, but the thing that really intrigued me was the fact that he's not only a Mormon, but he's a Mormon in a place where it's a little tougher to be one. He's not a Salt Lake City kid. He's a Chicago kid. It's tough. And I think I was drawn to him because of his character and what he was about, and I really wanted to do the story with a really sharp focus on how his religion affects who he is and how he plays.
Jeff Benedict wrote the profile of Jabari Parker for the current issue of Sports Illustrated. Jeff, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
You think running a pro sports venue would be a great job, what with the perks of getting to watch a lot of terrific games? Maybe most of the time, Staples Center Senior Vice President and General Manager Lee Zeidman would agree, but not as this weekend approached. As Thursday dawned, Mr. Zeidman had to be wondering how his building would accommodate two Lakers games, two Clippers games, two Kings games, and the crowded end of the country's largest stage bicycling race between that evening and Sunday night. He knew serious overtime in Sunday afternoon's Kings game would seriously foul up the start of the Clippers-Spurs game scheduled to come later, even if his employees, exhausted from turning the venue from a hockey rink into a round ball arena or vice versa multiple times, could set a record for getting the basketball floor down over the ice surface. So he had to hope for a hockey result in regulation. He also knew that the two-wheelers competing in the Amgen Tour of California would be rolling in just half an hour before the puck dropped. He could only hope that the free coffee and donuts he was offering would encourage lots of Kings fans to show up and take their seats really, really early so the bicyclists wouldn't crash into them as they tried to reach the building. And then he had to hope Clips fans would show up late so they wouldn't be trying to get in while the Kings fans were still trying to get out. Or, maybe, regarding Sunday night, Mr. Zeidman is hoping lots of people who hear this preface to potential chaos in L.A. will decide to catch the weekend's last two games on TV. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Tao Porchon Lynch first tried yoga when she was 8, and she must have liked it. She's still practicing yoga, and now she's 93. She has taught yoga to students in India, France, and the U.S., though her occupation has not entirely monopolized her time. She also enjoys ballroom dancing and guiding wine tours in New York State. Celebrated for having, quote, the best legs in Europe when she was a cabaret dancer in London in the mid-40s, Porchon Lynch has also worked as a model, an actress, and a scriptwriter. This week, Guinness World Records officially celebrated Tao Porchon Lynch as the world's oldest yoga teacher, which must have really irked Bernice Bates, the 91-year-old yoga teacher in Florida who'd been given that title only last year.
You make me feel so young. You make me feel there are songs to be sung.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a rugby devotee's celebration of the game he's survived so far. But first, professional golfer Ken Green had his heyday in the late 1980s, winning five PGA events and making it onto the United States Ryder Cup team. In 2008, at age 50, he made a successful transition to the Champions Tour. But as Green was traveling between tournaments in June of 2009, a highway accident changed his life and his career and, as Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports, set the stage for an amazing comeback.
In large italics atop his website, Ken Green writes, "God has thrown some big asteroids at me, and you have two choices. You get squished or you take them on." The biggest of those asteroids landed almost 3 years ago when his recreational vehicle blew a tire and veered off a Mississippi interstate. Green's brother, who was driving, his longtime girlfriend, and his German Shepherd were all killed. Green suffered head injuries, and his right leg below the knee was mangled. As he lay in a hospital 3 days later, he made his first major decision about keeping his career as a professional golfer alive.
With the leg just kind of hanging, which is what it would have been doing, just kind of, I'd have just dragged it everywhere, I would have had no chance at all to play any professional golf. So my feeling was, okay, we'll cut it off. I'll put the dopey prosthetic on and I'll play. I never gave it any thought as to how hard it really is going to be.
In just 5 months, Green started swinging a golf club, an action he found easier than climbing the stairs with his new prosthesis. Less than a year after his accident, he became the first amputee to play on the Champions Tour at the Liberty Mutual Legends of Golf tournament in Savannah, Georgia. The 53-year-old Green has competed in about a half dozen events since. Champions Tour president Mike Stevens says that Green's return ranks as one of golf's great comebacks.
It's got to be the top. I mean, I don't ever recall in my history and tenure in golf anyone attempting to come back and play, you know, from this severe of an injury, not just physically, but psychologically and emotionally, given all that happened in the accident.
But Green's road has been a lot rockier than he ever imagined. While Tiger Woods seems to reinvent his swing every few years to great fanfare, those changes pale compared to the adjustments Green has had to make. He demonstrates with a driver in his backyard.
I can't turn as much because I don't have the ability to turn off my hip for whatever reason. So when I come down, this left side of my body does that motion. And when you do that, you've lost a massive amount of power. And that's why I'm 20 yards or so shorter. I would be much better off if I had lost my left leg.
Since Green can't bend his right knee, shots for which the ball lies uphill or downhill from where he is standing have become much more difficult to make. His limitations have also forced him to abandon his left-to-right fade shot, which was his bread and butter during his pro career. If they had a golf tour in the Old Testament, Ken Green would have qualified as Job. Besides coping with his physical condition, which includes a continuous stabbing pain in his severed limb, Green also had to deal with the sudden death of his 21-year-old son from a drug overdose 2 years ago. To add insult to injury, Green's 2-year exemption from having to qualify for most Champions Tour events, earned on the strength of his earlier success on the PGA Tour, expired during the year he was recovering from his injuries. He appealed to tour officials to restore that lost eligibility.
I said, listen, I just want to do, again, it goes back to doing the right thing for, I want to help golf, I want to help, you know, kids, I want to help the wounded warriors, I want to help anybody disabled, and I want to help me. All I want is the year. I can do it in a year.
Instead, Green received an annually renewable major medical exemption. While Tour President Stevens claims that status should open up as many as half a dozen tournaments, Green doubts that he'll actually be eligible for more than one a year. Otherwise, he has to depend on the kindness of sponsors' exemptions to compete. If Green hasn't gotten much sympathy from the tour, he has received plenty of other support. Fellow senior golfers have raised more than $100,000 for him. Just last Tuesday, there was another fundraiser in his hometown of Danbury, Connecticut, where he received the key to the city. Michael Whitmer, who covers golf for the Boston Globe, adds that Green's recent adversity has softened what once was a prickly reputation in the golf world.
When he was on the tour, he was could be a hot-tempered guy. And, you know, he had issues with alcohol. I think people's opinion have changed a little bit based on what he's been through.
How far Green's comeback goes remains to be seen. Because he once played on the U.S. Ryder Cup team, he does have a lifetime exemption to the Senior PGA Championship, starting Thursday in Benton Harbor, Michigan. Green says that whether he plays will come down to a game-time decision, due to the unpredictability of his pain, which also has him pondering the more distant future.
If it doesn't get any better, you know, say by the end of this year, I'm going to have to make that decision. You're either going to just suffer, you know, like an idiot for a year and a half, 2 years, and do it, or don't. And knowing me, I'm going to suffer because I'm going to want to try it.
For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
Same old story. Like many aspiring athletes, Dan McLaughlin made his living photographing dental equipment, and then, predictably, the Portland, Oregon resident tried to launch a sparkling water company before deciding to practice golf full-time for 10,000 hours. Alan Bastable wrote about Dan McLaughlin's quest in Golf Magazine. Alan, welcome to Only a Game.
Good to be here. Thanks, Bill.
And also joining me is the golfer himself. Dan, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Let's start with you, Dan. Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, exposed you to the research of K. Anders Ericsson, who posited that anyone could excel at something after 10,000 hours of narrowly focused practice. Why golf?
You know, I had no experience with it. I just kind of looked at different aspects of life, and golf seemed to fit really well in that it was completely different than anything I'd ever done before. It was a mix of physical and mental abilities. You can, you know, track it very easily through an international handicap system.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody, it's in the limelight enough where people know exactly how difficult it is. And it's pretty much impossible to make it to the top, but it is theoretically possible.
Alan, Dan found a coach to oversee his experiment, which began in April of 2010. Tell us a few of the things about Dan's practice routine that surprised you.
Well, the first thing was probably the fact that he literally only had one club, which was his putter, for the first, I think, 5 or 6 months when he began this quest. Any golfer could tell you, you know, get a little boring out there practicing with a full set, let alone one club. So he was out there on practice greens just banging 3-foot putts, 5-foot putts, 20-foot putts. Didn't pick up a wedge until 6 months in. The round we played was the first round he had played at his home course with a full set of clubs, and that's 2 years after he began this process. So, you know, it's fairly staggering.
Dan, it's going to take you roughly another 4 years to get to those 10,000 hours of practice. You're 32 years old now. As a younger man, you changed colleges, you changed jobs, you dropped out of business school after, what was it, one class. Why are you confident that you'll stick with this this pursuit?
You know, I mean, throughout my entire life, I basically have done different pursuits, and basically as soon as I see that it's an easy thing to accomplish, I lose interest. And the one difference with golf is I don't think anybody ever gets to a point where they just can assume or know that they're going to be just good at the sport. I mean, it's a constant struggle, and for my personality, that's kind of the type of pursuit that I need.
What's your ultimate goal?
My ultimate kind of lofted goal is to play on a PGA Tour event, make the cut and play on the weekend. And then the goal of the project is just to show people what's possible just with hard work, kind of defeat this idea of talent, and hopefully inspire a lot of people to just follow the, you know, those deep-seated passions that they've had their whole life.
Assuming they have 10,000 hours with which to do it.
That's kind of a, you know, you go the farthest out example to kind of prove a point. But, you know, just in the 2,800 hours I put in so far, you know, I've made it down to a single-digit handicap. And that alone kind of shows people that you don't have to put in 10,000 hours. It's just every hour you put into whatever it is that you want to do, you're going to improve.
Well, that's very well put. Very well put. Alan, your article includes lots of stats about Dan's progress, more than 160,000 putts putted, more than 250,000 shots total, and Dan's best round through February was an 80. Based on those numbers and what you've seen, you think he's going to reach his goal?
Most golf people will tell you that you can get down to scratch or even, you know, minus handicap, but there's still this innate ability that only, I don't know, a few hundred golfers have on the planet. And either you've got it or you don't. So if he can get to the 6 years, maybe, who knows, you know, a nationwide tour, a mini tour will give him an exemption to an event. Maybe that'll one day lead to an exemption into a PGA Tour event, which would be awesome. I mean, I'd love to see it. But, you know, the notion that Dan, as much as I love Dan, the notion that he could contend on the PGA Tour, I think is a little far-fetched.
Alan Bastable's article about Dan McLaughlin is titled The 10,000-Hour Challenge, and it appears in the May issue of Golf Magazine. Alan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Absolutely. Thanks, Bill.
And Dan McLaughlin, thank you and good luck, and perhaps we'll check in long about, oh, I don't know, hour 8,500 or so.
Well, hopefully I hear from you before then. That'll be about 3 years from now, but I appreciate you having me on.
Jay Atkinson plays rugby. He's been doing it for decades, and in his new book, Memoirs of a Rugby-Playing Man, Guts, Glory, and Blood in the World's Greatest Game, he explores how rugby has helped form his identity, even as it has beaten him up. Jay Atkinson joins me now in the studio. Welcome back to Only a Game.
My pleasure, Bill. Really happy to be here with you.
You write that when you played your first rugby match, you were in college at the time, quote, I had no idea that I was entering a new life. How and when did that realization come upon you?
I was sort of a jack-of-all-trades sports-wise. I had a little dalliance with junior A hockey. I mean, I sort of dated a lot of sports, and then I finally found the sport I wanted to settle down with, you know. And I kind of knew it instantly. I went to a couple practices, and the first time they gave me the ball, they said, you can kick the ball along the ground. Nobody can tackle you when the ball is on the ground, and then you can retrieve your own kick. So I just kicked it down the field into the end goal, ran down, jumped on it, and they said, you just scored. I said, I like this game. Kind of combined the things I was good at, which was sort of like devious little movements that nobody else was expecting.
Well, beyond the devious little movements, you maintain in the book that rugby gave you what you call a sense of authenticity. Why was that more true of rugby than, say, soccer or hockey or wrestling?
There's something about physical courage that's necessary to enter into a scrum, to be tackled without any equipment on, that somehow gets reaffirmed not only when you play in your first match, but when you go to your first after-match party. In hockey, you don't go out with the other team. You usually hate them, even after the game's over. But with rugby, both teams and the referee would be at the bar, and people that you are in bloodlust combat with an hour earlier would buy you a beer, put an arm around your shoulder, and ask you where you were from. And that made me want to travel to the 14 countries I eventually traveled to play the game.
Some of the more intriguing passages in this book, at least for me, are not about rugby. They're about your relationships with two writers, of whom our listeners may be aware, Harry Cruz down in Florida and Andre Dubas Jr. Neither of them played rugby, but you attribute to Cruz what you call the qualities of a rugby man. Why?
I knew him at the height of his powers. Like, I was at University of Florida in the early 80s, and he had just published 10 novels in 10 years. And as I say in the book, he had not done it quietly or humbly. So he had this sort of larger-than-life reputation as a brawler and as an outspoken guy on campus and in American literature generally. I remember him saying to class one night, someday some one of you may go off and write something really fine that demands an enormous amount of the reader and gives the reader back that much. Pause. But that ain't where we are tonight. And, you know, his ability to be completely candid in all situations and his sort of comic self-awareness, his loyalty, his insouciance among his peers, those are rugby qualities.
I'm speaking with Jay Atkinson about his new book, Memoirs of a Rugby Playing Man, and you're listening to Only a Game. You and Harry Cruz nearly squared off at your first meeting, the first creative writing class you attended at Florida. Was this a matter of writers competing with each other or the influence of some leftover rugby adrenaline?
I had just come from rugby practice. I was a few minutes late. I was running to what was then called the GPA building, the English department at University of Florida. I saw Harry, who I didn't know was Harry. I thought he was a janitor. I said, hey, chief, can you direct me to fiction writing? And he grunted and pointed to the door. And I was like, oh, this guy's the professor. Uh-oh. And But I already had, you know, I already had a black eye from rugby practice. My first practice, I got an elbow right in the face. I had a black eye. I had a lot of adrenaline because it was my first graduate school fiction writing class, and I was coming from the rugby pitch, and he gave out these instructions, and his accent was like he talked about as fast as a possum does arithmetic. I couldn't follow a word he was saying in that Georgia drawl, and then I raised my hand and said, "Excuse me, professor, I couldn't understand what you were saying because of your accent." And you could have heard, like, you know, a half a pin drop in that room. People were mortified that I challenged Harry Cruz on his accent, which was his whole identity, was his Bacon County, like, origins, which I didn't even know who the guy was. And he said, you know, "I don't much like your accent either, and we can go outside and settle this right now." And I was coming from rugby practice. I thought, well, maybe this is part of the curriculum, University of Florida. You're expected to go out into industrial lit hallways and fight like dogs with your professor. Then the preeminent student, like, gets his degree.
You make a case in the book for rugby as a tremendously attractive sport for the players, maybe even addictive for the players, but as a spectator sport, not so much. Why has it not caught on here in this country as a spectator sport?
That's a really great question, Bill, because we're at a pivotal moment in American rugby. Rugby will be an Olympic sport in 2016. And the rugby that will be played in the Olympics and the rugby that's now being televised in the U.S. because there is a national television contract, I think it's with NBC, is seven-a-side rugby. And that sport will be a gateway sport to people to appreciate, I think, the finer points of rugby union, where there's a full scrum and there's 15 men against 15 men. But over the next 3 years, you'll see a lot more rugby on television. You'll see a greater upward climb towards more acceptance, respectability, and recognition.
Jay Atkinson is the author of Memoirs of a Rugby Playing Man, Guts, Glory, and Blood in the World's Greatest Game. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Jay, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure, Bill.
I am a rugby fan. I come from down your way, and I can play the Gauteng Lions.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. This is NPR.
New York Rangers coach John Tortorella has developed a reputation for being singularly unresponsive in post-game press conferences. His meeting with the press following the team's Wednesday night loss to the New Jersey Devils did nothing to tarnish that reputation. "What went wrong?" the coach was asked. "A number of things," he said. "Did you feel this was the kind of effort you needed to win the game?" he was asked. "No," said Mr. Tortorella. "Are you disappointed in this showing?" "I answered your first question," said the coach, evidently figuring that reporter deserved only one answer. All this in case you were wondering why articles about the Rangers-Devils series have included reports on the condition of the ice, concession sales, and the acoustics in the building. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Manchester City cures itself of cityitis. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce from WBEZ in Chicago. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
New Orleans Saints linebacker Jonathan Vilma has filed a defamation lawsuit against NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who suspended Vilma for the entire 2012 season for allegedly taking part in the Saints' Bountygate scheme. What does Vilma stand to gain from this remarkable legal move?
Absolutely nothing, because he wasn't defamed. Once again, we have to resort to the wonderful jurisprudential institution known as the discovery process to explain to you why Jonathan Vilma is not going to pursue this beyond its opening press conference.
New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees said this week that his contract talks with the team had been, quote, extremely frustrating. Is this because everybody in the front office has been suspended, so there's nobody with whom Mr. Brees can negotiate?
Boy, it's just a barrel of laughs down there at this point, isn't it? I'm sure there's somebody in there, whether it's the janitor or somebody in the you know, the marketing department who's trying to negotiate a contract. If I'm Drew Brees, I'm looking at the New Orleans Saints and thinking, you know, I'm a really talented guy. I've already won a Super Bowl here. Do I really want to be around this circus?
The Indiana Pacers hold a surprising 2-1 lead over the Miami Heat in the second round of the NBA postseason. They were so good Thursday night that Dwayne Wade and Heat head coach Eric Spoelstra exchanged angry words on the sidelines. Are the Heat cooked?
The Heat are in danger of being cooked. A lot will depend on what happens Sunday afternoon. They look like they're dissolving internally. Eric Spoelstra's grip on the team has never looked weaker. LeBron James is having his own problems. Dwayne Wade is yelling at the coach, and Chris Bosh is hurt. So unless you're a really big Mario Chalmers fan, you have to say the Heat is in big trouble.
Pacers president Larry Bird can add NBA Executive of the Year to his resume, which includes Coach of the Year. He was Rookie of the Year in 1980, and of course he won 3 MVP awards. Has he earned this latest major award?
Well, I mean, judging by the playoffs, he certainly has. This is a very, you know, he put together a very interesting bunch of players who are gelling at the right time. He found, a real use for Roy Hibbert, who had been considered to be largely a waste before, you know, prior to this season. And, I think looking at what the Pacers are doing, he's certainly eligible.
Patrick Gonzalez, a student at Woodlake Hills Middle School in San Antonio, was suspended from school on Thursday, Charlie, because he had a head shaving which depicted San Antonio Spurs forward Matt Bonner. The bad news is that he had to shave off the head shaving. The good news is that Gonzalez attended Thursday night's game, courtesy of the Spurs, and he met Mr. Bonner. How can a kid be suspended for being a basketball fan?
Well, first of all, to get rid of a head shaving, don't you have to shave off the rest of the hair?
Either that or you have an extremely careful barber.
But I think Matt Bonner had the perfect solution for all involved, which is to tell the school to sit the kid in the back of the classroom so nobody can see the back of his head anyway.
They'd all be walking around the classroom just to see him. I'm sure it would have completely ruined the entire school day for as long as that
kid. Yes, because as we know, students in middle school and elementary school are paying enormously close attention to school in May.
Los Angeles Kings have certainly been the story of the NHL postseason, Charlie. They are the Western Conference's 8th seed, but they've so far knocked out number 1 seed Vancouver, number 2 seed St. Louis, and now they hold a 3-1 lead over number 3 seed Phoenix. So what do you think? Are you rooting for the Los Angeles Kings to take home Lord Stanley's Cup?
Well, considering that Los Angeles Kings are what passes for old school in the NHL Western Conference, mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I am, but you have to be impressed by the playoff run. They absolutely demolished Phoenix the other night, and you know right now they've got a hot goalie. They're playing an entertaining form of hockey. They're not playing the clutch and grab stupidity that the New York Rangers are playing. Yeah, I'm rooting for the Kings.
Former Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling has been in the news this week. Is he contemplating a comeback?
No, he's contemplating soaking the state of Rhode Island for some more money for his struggling video game startup, 38 Studios. Kurt is, as you know, an outspoken conservative and believes in a government just big enough to fit into his wallet.
Let's take a moment now to congratulate Marlon Esparza, who on Tuesday became the first American female Olympic boxer. How do you like her chances in London?
I have no idea. I don't know what the rest of the female boxers around the world are like, but congratulations to her. She's a flyweight. Her final was before everybody else's, so she's the first member of the first American women's boxing team. Although I have to admit, it is a little bit odd after all we heard for 20 years about getting boxing out of the Olympics. They're putting more boxing into the Olympics. Somebody knows something.
Manchester City secured the Premiership title on Sunday, and the number of U.S. viewers watching the English League's final match was more than 1,300,000, 72% higher than last year's audience for the same weekend. What do you think accounts for the increase?
Well, obviously, there are millions and millions of Manchester City fans all around the country. The Premier League has done a terrific job marketing itself on American cable television. There are the Fox Sports Channel, in Massachusetts. We pick up the Liverpool games because of the ownership deal they have with the Red Sox. They've actually gone out of their way to market the sport to an American cable TV audience. And never underestimate the appeal of live sports in the daytime. I've said this always about daytime baseball, and I believe in daytime soccer, too. Fans are looking for stuff to, get away from work to watch.
And finally, Charlie, in our ongoing attempt to support creative promotions by minor league baseball teams, I invite you to salute the Charleston River Dogs, not for the event itself, which is a home run derby, no big deal there, but for the choice of venue, which is the aircraft carrier, the USS Yorktown.
Well, I don't understand. This is one I don't understand. Is it that hard to hit a baseball off an aircraft carrier?
Maybe they're using
Nerf
balls.
I mean, they must have been hitting it the length of the flight deck, right?
Yeah, gotta be.
Because hitting it the width of the flight deck isn't that big a deal.
You can find Charlie Pierce's writing about sports at Grantland. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Sports are very confusing.
England's Premiership season ended on Sunday with Manchester City at the top of the standings. Sorry, the table, as the English so foppishly put it. In any case, it wasn't an easy trip. Joining me to discuss what some have called the most exciting finish ever in the Premiership is Roger Bennett, co-host of Men in Blazers, which you can find on the Grantland website, and soccer columnist for ESPN.com. Roger, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, thanks for having me.
Manchester City's crosstown neighbor is Manchester United, one of the wealthiest, most popular, and most accomplished soccer sides in the world. Explain for the members of our audience unfamiliar with soccer in England what it meant for Manchester City to top Man U.
Well, the day itself, last Sunday, it was a little bit like watching Manchester City's bar mitzvah, Bill. It was like the day they truly became a man. It was a little bit like watching Roger Clinton just completely outfox, outdo, and overwhelm Bill Clinton. United are a powerhouse of modern sport. They are an Uber franchise who Forbes valued, I think, $368 million more than the Yankees or the Cowboys. City have had decades, 44 years of comedy. They've been long-suffering. Every time they've come near glory, they've managed to self-harm. A great friend of mine who now lives in Brooklyn, Johnny, Manchester-born and bred, and I emailed with him right before the game, which he watched in the Manchester City bar in New York City. I asked him how he's feeling. They only had to crush this pathetic team, Queen's Park Rangers. A blowout was expected to clinch the title. And Johnny wrote to me, "I feel excitement, cancelled out by fear, cancelled out by belief, cancelled out by a lifetime of bitter disappointment."
Well, until the final moments of Manchester City's match against Queen's Park Rangers on Sunday, it looked as if mighty Man U might triumph after all. Tell us about the especially unlikely closing moments of Manchester City's last game of the season.
Yeah, I mean, City were playing Queen's Park Rangers. A coronation, a blowout was expected, but City toiled. Perhaps it was nerves. They went ahead in the first half, but in the second half, their defender, Joleon Lescott, muffed a routine ball in what can be called Bill Buckner-esque fashion. And shockingly, Queen's Park Rangers pounced. The score was 1-1. And Manchester United, who were winning their game away at Sunderland, were suddenly in the improbable position of being champions. As the clock ticked down, QPR went ahead, even though they were suddenly down to 10 men. A miracle goal. And Manchester City, it looked like their old history had seeped back into the present day and that they'd fluffed it. And the announcer was 5 minutes to go. Manchester City 2-1 down. Manchester City fans started to leave the stadium, Bill. But first, in the 91st minute, a Bosnian lump, whose nickname is the Lamppost because he's been so immobile all season, headed the ball home 2-2. There was still hope. And then with 90 seconds to go, Bill, 90 seconds, a Hollywood ending, an Argentinian, Kun Aguero, burst through a mosh pit of players. And he kept his composure as the bodies flew, smacked the ball home. 9 months of football, 380 games, 1,066 goals, and the tournament was all won by the last kick of the ball.
Roger, would it be fair to compare Manchester City's triumph to the Red Sox finally winning the World Series in 2004, or perhaps the U.S. men's hockey team beating the Soviet team at the 1980 Olympics?
Well, it's a great question, Bill. I think the key to understanding this is that Manchester City are no little train that could. I mean, they've had $1.6 billion pumped into them by Sheikh Mansour, and it was that $1.6 billion that cured their psychic condition. So we are entering a new era in which Arab billionaires will finally get the accolades they've been denied for so long. But we polled the listeners of our show, Men in Blazers, to really try and translate this through to American realities, and they came back to us loud and clear and said, there's no direct parallel, Bill, and they had to build a Frankenstein monster of American sporting elements. I take you back to September the 28th, 2011, last day of the baseball season.
Right.
Rays, Yankees, Red Sox, St. Louis still battling all the way to game 162. The Braves, the Red Sox blowing 3-2 leads. The Rays digging out of that 7-zip hole against the Yankees. Evan Longoria's walk-off home run. The challenge with that is that they didn't win a championship. So when I saw it, I thought of one thing and one thing only. Joe Carter, 1993, walk-off home run, Game 6 in the World Series, ninth inning, down 6-5, two men on, two strikes against him, home run. But the Blue Jays and the Phillies, they don't hate each other like Manchester United and Manchester City. I would throw in a bit of the 2004 ALCS Red Sox-Yankees game. And I think if you throw those three things together, you could just about sum up what was last Sunday.
Roger Bennett is the host of Men in Blazers, and he's the soccer columnist for ESPN.com as well. And he's, of course, written about soccer for various other publications. Roger, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Always a pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
To find out why Roger has his lederhosen all in a bunch over this weekend's Champions League final featuring Chelsea and Bayern Munich, please visit onlyagame.org. The experts tell me that this has been a relatively boring season in NASCAR. Fans have been complaining about long stretches of green flag racing, which is apparently a bad thing. Last weekend's Southern 500 at Darlington did a lot to quiet those complaints, with a dramatic win by five-time Sprint Cup champion Jimmy Johnson and an even more dramatic post-race scuffle between Bad Boy driver Kurt Busch and Ryan Newman's pit crew. Joining me to explain it all is Stephen Levine, who covers NASCAR for the Sporting News and Rowdy.com. Stephen, did fans get what they were aching for during last week's race?
Yeah, I think fans did. I'm not so sure NASCAR did, although if they know what's good for them, they should be applauding Kurt Busch. A little bit of this, you know, is exactly the panacea that NASCAR needs to bring some eyeballs back to the sport.
The kerfuffle between Busch and Newman started when a flat tire caused Busch to wreck with six laps to go. Both drivers took pit stops, but Busch burned out through Newman's pit box on his way back to the track. Newman's crew was already angry, so probably not a great idea for Busch to accidentally on purpose run into Newman's car on pit row after the race, right?
Well, right. I mean, Kurt Busch says, I was taking my helmet off, and it was completely by accident, Ryan, that I ran into your car. And look, Kurt Busch has a temper. He lost his ride at Penske Racing because of his temper, and this season is supposed to be the season in which he rebuilds his image. So far, he's not doing a really good job of that.
Well, he was fined $50,000 for this most recent loss of temper. Will that calm him down any?
You know, finding Kurt Busch $50,000 is kind of like you and me giving up our double tall skinny hazelnut lattes for a month. It really doesn't have a great impact. If NASCAR really thought that what he did was egregious, I think they would have docked him some points. It was a financial fine and probation. Probation in NASCAR parlance, it's like as punitive as double secret probation was, in Animal House. It doesn't really mean anything.
Sports Illustrated called the altercation, quote, the moment NASCAR needed. I think they agree with you. NASCAR apparently agreed because the longest penalty went to Craig Strickler, Bush's motorhome driver. He was fined and put on probation, if not double secret probation, through the end of the year. What did he do to earn that?
We assume he was down there to help extricate Kurt Busch to keep the incident from escalating, a job at which he failed miserably, but really where he stepped over the line is he put his hand up in front of one of the Fox Sports cameras. Fox, of course, pays mightily for the privilege of broadcasting this race to the masses. It's sort of like NASCAR's lifeline to the public, and you just don't mess with the broadcast, and especially not a motorhome driver. I mean, come on, if it was a big, burly gas man or a jack man or a tire carrier, that's one thing. But this guy in a button-down shirt with some goofy hat on driving a golf cart, it's not the guy you want to be the face of the revolution.
I guess you really don't mess with the broadcast if what's being broadcast is a fight.
There you go. Remember the Daytona 500 in 1979 between Cale Yarborough and the Allison brothers? You know, that sort of brought NASCAR this massive audience, these fisticuffs. And this used to be much more commonplace than it is now. So now, when tempers flare and fists are thrown, man, we got to get the cameras in there quickly because we don't know when we're going to have the privilege of viewing such tempers again.
Stephen Levine covers NASCAR for the Sporting News and Rowdy.com. Stephen, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Bill. It was my pleasure.
When they hit that track, they ain't looking back. They don't give no price for that.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Mary Gaffney at WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks to our departing intern, Jeremy Conlin. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, please visit onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from ESPN's Roger Bennett, who's been tracking the recent growth of an exotic sport.
Football is slowly taking on. I think it's just overtaken competitive pogo sticking in terms of popularity in this country.
Well, the NFL has come a long way in recent years. Oh, you mean soccer. Never mind. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from Valvoline, maker of next-gen motor oil, engine protection with oil made from 50% recycled stock. Learn more at Valvoline.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. And the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.